In 520 BC, the ever-fractious Elamites rose again in revolt. Darius, infuriated, promptly anathematized them in new and startling terms. "Those Elamites were faithless," he thundered. "They failed to worship Ahura Mazda." The condemnation of a people for their neglect of a religion not their own, was something wholly remarkable. Until that moment, Darius, following the subtle policy of Cyrus, had always been assiduous in his attention to foreign gods. Now he was delivering to the subject nations of the world a stern and novel warning. Should a people persist in rebellion against the order of Ahura Mazda, they might expect to be regarded not merely as adherents of the lie, but as the worshippers of false gods and demons. Conversely, those sent to war against them might expect divine blessings, both in their lives and after death. Glory on earth and an eternity in heaven, these were the assurances given by Darius to his men. The manifesto proved an inspiring one. When Gobryas, Darius's father-in-law, led an army into Elam, he was able to crush the revolt there with a peremptory, almost dismissive speed. Never again would the Elamites dare to challenge the awful might of the Persian king. Such was the effect of the world's first holy war. At Susa, capital of the defeated Elamites, orders were given to flatten much of the old town and construct an immense new royal city, one raised in contempt of the site itself. Darius, not content with building one new capital from scratch, then began scouting round virgin sites in Persia itself, looking to found a second and even greater one. He settled upon a site already lit up by his glory. This was the Mount of Mercy, a name not without irony, for it was at its foot that Vaia's daughter and the rebel nobles had been impaled. Now, abutting the slope of the mountain, Darius ordered the construction of a gigantic terrace, a platform with perfect views onto the killing field below, beautiful and impervious, a fitting base for the capital of the world. Darius named it Parsa. The city which the Greeks would much later call Persepolis was built as nerve centre, powerhouse and showcase not only of Persia, but of the realms of the vast dominion beyond it. The financial crisis that had racked the empire in the last year of Cambyses' reign was briskly resolved. The ramshackle system of tribute that had prevailed under Cyrus and his sons was streamlined and reformed. Levies in every province, to the far ends of the known world, were carefully fixed. It was an unprecedented achievement, and one destined to endure for almost two centuries as the bedrock of Persian power. Admittedly, unprecedented though the great king's reach was, it didn't yet quite embrace every limit of the world. Beyond the Jaxartes River, the steppe lands of Asia still stretched unconquered to the remote and circling River Ranga. In Africa, a Persian army, dispatched westwards by Cambyses, had been swallowed whole by a desert storm. In Europe, across the sea from the cities of Ionia, an entire strange continent, as yet barely even explored, was waiting to be penetrated and subdued. In 518 BC, gazing eastwards, Darius dispatched a naval squadron to reconnoitre the mysterious lands along the Indus. Invasion swiftly followed. The Punjab was subdued. A tribute of gold dust, elephants, and similar wonders was imposed. With the rich plains of the Indus pacified, his attentions could now be turned to the opposite end of his dominion. Two continents had already submitted to his supremacy. Why shouldn't a third? The gaze of the great king inexorably began to fix itself on the west.